So those two need to meet both on risk and impact targets. And it's quite the negotiation challenge, I would say.
Innovations in Sustainable Finance. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Julian Kölbel.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Innovations in Sustainable Finance. I'm Julian Kölbel, assistant professor at the University of St. Gallen. Today, I want to talk again about blended finance. In fact, the topic that I started the podcast with, I'm going to return to that, but with a new guest. Welcome to the show, Nadia.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Nadia is a very seasoned expert in the area of blended finance, and I'm fortunate to have her here. We're going to talk about the question, how to succeed in blended finance. Blended finance is a simple and powerful concept. You mix concessionary capital with private capital to finance projects that yield financial returns and public benefits. So far, the idea, but putting it into practice is often not so simple and requires a lot of skill and knowledge. So that's what I'd like to dive in with you, Nadia. Nadia Nikolova is Managing Director at Allianz Global Investors, and I'll start this by asking you, how did you get into blended finance?
Funny story, actually. I was a portfolio manager at the infrastructure debt team at Allianz Global Investors, and we took a meeting with the International Finance Corporation. We're talking probably 2015, a decade ago. And they were capital constrained at the time, so they were looking to mobilize institutional investors into infrastructure debt in emerging markets. They had an impressive track record. However, we continued working for an insurance-backed institution, which meant that we needed to get those single B, double B loans into investment grade. The head of the infrastructure debt team and myself both came from structured finance background, so we said, oh, that can happen, give us a first loss. And we didn't even know it was called blended finance. Fast forward months and months of negotiations, not to say years of negotiations, we rolled out our first blended finance fund together with the IFC. For us, it was something that made sense. We brought in large-scale institutional capital. We took advantage of a solid track record of the International Finance Corporation. We made sure the incentives were correct, and they provided us with a first loss on the portfolio. So it was a win-win for everyone.
That's very interesting. So in a way, you're saying blended finance in this instance is just finance.
Structured finance.
Structured finance. So how would you, I've given my interpretation, but how would you characterize the core idea of blended finance? What is it all about? You mentioned first loss. Is that something that's always there?
Doesn't necessarily need to be. Blended finance is a term that allows the combination of different levels of capital that have different risk return expectations with the ultimate goal and impact expectations with the ultimate goal of private capital mobilization into projects that otherwise wouldn't have been done if it wasn't for the blending. That sort of de-risking can come in a form of a first loss, it can come in a form of a guarantee, it can come in a form of a incremental return. It can come in all sorts of different ways, but it's usually targeted at two things. It's targeted at either reducing the perception of risk or the actual risk of an underlying investment, or the perception of a too low return for the risk. So different instruments are targeting at essentially always at getting investors where they wouldn't invest otherwise, but it could be either for risk mitigation or return enhancement.
Can you just give us a really concrete example where we might understand that in practical terms?
Sure. A few years ago, we launched a fund with the Dutch Development Bank, the FMO, whereby we co-invest alongside them in typical single B and double B loans, that essentially alongside the three sustainable development goals. Within that fund, we mobilized $1 billion of institutional capital who wouldn't have co-invested alongside FMO without some sort of de-risking. So what was required was similar to the prior case that I described with IFCs for FMO to provide essentially a first loss capital into that structure. The investors were not interested to invest in the fund for two primary reasons. One is they didn't want to invest 20 years single B and double B in emerging markets risk. So we had to both try to shorten the duration for them of their underlying investments and two, reduce the risk. So the first loss and essentially the priority of payments within that structure allowed institutional investors to have shorter duration. So they're expected to be there for significantly less than 25 years and have a risk return profile that's commensurate to investment grade. In that structure, however, FMO wouldn't have been able to take the first loss if it wasn't for a guarantee of MacArthur Foundation that essentially provided a $25 million unfunded guarantee to the first loss within the fund. So
there were three parties.
Yeah. So if it wasn't for MacArthur, FMO wouldn't have come in. If it wasn't for FMO, the institutional investors wouldn't have not come in. And that's really important because if investors would have done the deal without any of the other parties, we would have been creating market distortion. And so the need for blending as well as the amount of blending are something that in every transaction need to be scrutinized in order to assure that there isn't the market distortion.
You mentioned something very interesting. You said if it weren't for the first party, MacArthur Foundation, FMO wouldn't have done it. And if it weren't then for FMO, the private investors wouldn't have done it. So who starts these kinds of things?
In that example, it was actually us. And the IFC example, it was IFC. They were capital constrained. They came to us in this transaction. I was convinced the blended finance made so much sense. So we looked for additional parties that we could collaborate with. FMO had a particular setup that they had an investment management company within the bank that was there for private capital mobilization. One of the core aspects of blended finance is assuring that everyone's incentives are right. So already if you're working with an institution that doesn't want to mobilize private capital, you have got one incentive in place. You have gotten the top leadership support for private capital mobilization, and that's really important. So we started a conversation. I chased the CEO of FMO Investment Management at a conference in the Netherlands. And we sat down together, actually with Allianz, with the balance sheet. We sat down together with her at that conference in a cafe, and we took out some paper with some napkins and a pen, and we started scribbling what was going to be our SDG loan fund a few years from then. And they brought the MacArthur Foundation, given they had much closer relationship with the foundations at the time. A lot of what happens in our business is about people and the right people and getting them on board. Because again, it goes back to the incentives and trust.
I was about to go exactly in this direction. It seems this is, as in other cross-organizational collaborations where quite a bit is at stake, it's at the beginning fundamental to build trust, isn't it?
At the beginning and over time. You're entering into a 20, 25-year partnerships in some of these cases. And institutions would go through their ups and downs. And I think it's incredibly important to build and work through that relationship over time. Usually the trust relationship starts between the individuals and over time needs to transfer to the institutions.
Yeah. How do you do that?
That's a great question. You build the next generation of people that are one, trustworthy, believe in what we're doing, technically competent, and put at the heart the interest of all the investors in the fund and all the partners. But it's about building up the next generation.
Yeah. I guess that's one of the reasons why blended finance deals are, you know, they just require skill and sophistication, people management, building trust, right? It sort of has all the bells and whistles, really, that you need in complex transactions. So in that sense, nothing new, perhaps, but it is, I think, very important to stress that this is at the core of it. It's just, you know, good projects where all incentives are aligned. But if you can sort of give three things that you need that you think need to be in place for a blended finance structure to be successful? What would you say?
Top level leadership. Every time I have seen these transactions actually work out well, it's because in each of the institutions, there is a believer and a supporter.
Who is
And we're very
up.
Lucky that in a, between our institutional investors, FMO, MacArthur, Allianz, ourselves, there was very senior support. Because these transactions are complex, they take time. There is an opportunity cost that's attached of the team's time, of everyone's time. I think at one point on the projects, we had also 40 people involved to make sure that operations and everything, legal, regulatory, and all sorts of aspects are really considered. There's a huge opportunity cost that goes with that. So first is management and top leadership support. Second, I would say is track record. It's absolutely paramount to, if you are to attract institutional investors, is to be able to have something to show for. That's why we went with the institutions that were transparent on their track record and their processes. And third, I would say somebody in the equation needs to have flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
What happens very often is you're working with the regulated institutional investors, insurance companies, pension funds, and so on. And quite sometimes even also regulated development banks, but they also have their own processes and systems and so on in place. So there is relatively little flexibility.
Yeah.
Within for maneuvering. It was really paramount is actually that we had a foundation involved in this project that had flexible capital. They could come as an investor, they could come as a guarantor, they could come at this level or that level. And because you never know what would come up when you're fundraising and when you're out there in the market and when you're structuring the product, you don't know what the regulatory implications, the tax implications are going to be. Having one part or one element of the structure that can be flexible makes an absolute difference. So in addition to the trust, I would say leadership, track record, flexibility.
Leadership, track record, flexibility. That's a great list. So let's go a little bit into the project side and the potential. So let's say these three things are in place and things go well. What is really the potential of blended finance when it works? What could be achieved?
Well, the core of it stands the attracting large-scale private capital to an asset class they wouldn't have invested previously. So it's on for, if you think from an institutional perspective, it brings diversification to their returns, uncorrelated portfolios, some pickup. So it makes a happy investor. Actually, in market volatility, blended finances seem to be a very resilient part of the portfolio and has provided for a very good diversification component. So it makes for a happy investor. For the development banks, it helps them with their private capital mobilization ratios. But fundamentally, what it helps is it helps to channel more capital where it's needed. And in an era where we are seeing aid agency going away, where we're seeing development finance being reduced because government budgets are going more to defense now that rather than development, the need for private capital in order to get to a more equitable world at all is unquestionable. So what blended finance does is allows for that capital to flow, which is even more important today than it was yesterday.
Right, yes. Certainly the world has changed dramatically in this regard. Can I ask you to be even a little bit more specific when we think about, you know, you said it directs capital to where it is needed. So what are some of the things that are needed in your view?
And look, blended finance is a technique. You can address the capital flow to where the priorities for that group of investors are. Some target decarbonization. If you think about it, we are working in a world in which over 60% of the world's emissions are generated in emerging markets for Western consumption. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And they're growing at double-digit rates. So if we are at all to solve the climate crisis on the supply side, we cannot ignore the EM investment need. So the decarbonization, especially of middle-income countries, is paramount. And that includes, that requires investment, investment that's not necessarily going to come from governments. It's not, again, coming from the development sector in the scale that it's needed. Therefore, we need to start looking into private capital. Then we talk about poverty elimination, right? That means creation of jobs. That means supporting small and medium enterprises. Development finance can support in that respect significantly. Whether you invest in local financial institutions that then on-lend, or you're directly investing in small and medium enterprises, blending can allow for some of that capital to flow in this respect. And then, of course, there's a whole component around general inclusive capitalism, whether we talk about healthcare or education, where the primary healthcare and the primary education is failing, of how can we support businesses in order to ensure that we have acceptable levels of healthcare and education. Again, I'm not talking about aid. I'm talking about investments that are generating yeah. return. And of course, then is agriculture. It's an incredibly important segment that needs to be addressed. Forestry, you name it. Again, different investors have different priorities, and blending is just a technique to allow for capital to flow.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that this is a technique that could be put to a variety of ends. And it seems to me that one player, the most flexible player that you mentioned earlier, so I think that in our example, that was the MacArthur Foundation. So their view of what the priorities are in terms of, you know, is it going to be decarbonization or is it going to be job creation in agriculture? They would probably have an important say in that, right? Because they're at the end of the day, they're sort of paying for it, if you will. Whereas investors come in, as you say, they're happy investors because everything has been prepared for them so that they can invest.
In theory, that's correct. In practice, that is not exactly how it works. They have to compromise each. And then what do I mean with that? The experience we build over time and continue seeing is that a lot of the utility capital, so a lot of that junior subordinated first loss, however you want to call it, philanthropic capital, given the chance, they would want to invest in a very narrow thematic in a very tight jurisdiction. So they would want to do least developed countries, and don't mean MacArthur, they in the catalytic capital. They would want to do least developed countries, education, for instance. That would mean an incredibly small investment universe and a very concentrated investment universe. Institutional investors, on the other hand, might be more interested in decarbonization because they have made some targets in their portfolio, might be interested in middle-income countries, and don't even know where some of the least developed countries are. They don't even have them as part of their target portfolios. So those two need to meet both on risk and impact targets. And it's quite the negotiation challenge, I would say, to bring those parties together. Where we were very lucky with MacArthur is that they were working on what's called the C3 initiative on the Catalytic Capital Consortium to showcase how Catalytic Capital can essentially scale finance. So they had the flexibility not to have a very narrow investment in impact universe and therefore not restrict tremendously the investment universe and still get the investors there. Again, that tension, the less available catalytic capital is, the more impactful they want to be in its entirety. And the more that differs from the investors who want as large, as diversified and as least correlated possible strategies. Interesting balance to balance.
Yeah, I think that is indeed very interesting and gives a bit of flavor to that transition from theory to success in practice that I wanted to get into. Makes a lot of sense to me that first of all, that's what a foundation, let me say, would want to do, right? They have their purpose statement, and that's what they have to do also to some extent. So often it may not be so easy for them as well to embark on that sort of flexibility.
Absolutely. Also the tax status, right?
Yeah.
A lot of what they're able to relate is either PRI on a mission-related or program-related investment. So they have to also sit into a certain framework.
But in some sense, in some way, that makes a lot of sense to me because it is an optimization problem at the end, right? You're trying to optimize the financing structure for a given set of projects. And if you have too many constraints on all sides, then it just becomes more difficult.
You know how I think about it?
How do you
often
think about it?
Often I visualize a Jenga. And each...
This tower?
The tower with the little wooden blocks in them, and everyone takes one at a time because, you know, we need these countries and we need investment grade and we need that duration. And,
okay.
And as a manager, you're sitting there trying to keep the tower standing. So, and not necessarily being able to add blocks into the Jenga. So it's the thing that makes it work is that at the end of the day, the common goal is that they want it to keep to be standing at the end of at the end, right? So it requires an incredible level of transparency of this is really a boundary for me. I'm not negotiating for the sake of negotiating.
So it certainly is a balancing act, and it needs people who are committed to keeping things in balance or even to get the different pieces in place to begin with. Now, in this current environment, governments such as Germany, for example, they are newly planning to deploy vast amounts of capital to boost infrastructure, for example. So that would not be a developing country context. But do you still think that has, you know, that could be a big moment for blended finance as well?
Again, blended finance needs to be used where capital would otherwise not flow. Today, in regulatory environments like Germany, we haven't seen a lack of institutional capital wanting to flow. Now, there are other aspects of the Green Deal, for instance, where maybe some blending is required. But I think it's important that we don't distort markets. So if institutional investors would fund renewables or transmission and distribution networks, without a level of blending, we should not be blending. And there's been a lot of incentives from a solvency perspective, for instance, for infrastructure investments, lower capital charges. And that's why we have seen. So when we started infrastructure debt 2012, 2013, Italians Global Investors, there weren't that many institutional investors. I think we were one of the first ones to set up an infrastructure debt strategy. Now every investor, more or less out there, institutional investor, has an allocation to infrastructure debt. So if places, because you mentioned Germany, if places like Germany are indeed having projects that are bankable or financeable, then we shouldn't be using blending for those.
Right. Okay. You mentioned not distorting markets. So from whose perspective is that important? I mean, I certainly see how you don't want to, as the first loss tranche, you don't want to, you know, provide your first loss to something that otherwise would have happened, you know, just with a regular financing. And you end up just subsidizing the investors who would have done it anyways, right? That's something you don't want to have. Or do you have a more macro concern about this?
It's both from a first loss perspective. First loss is scarce, right? And therefore, there's an opportunity cost. If we used it for something that didn't need it, then something else that really needed it didn't get done on the one hand side. On the other hand side, most of the times where that comes from government budgets, it comes from our taxes. So at some point, if let's keep it within a European context, it becomes a redistribution of wealth. So if something was meant for development, it should really go to development. So it shouldn't have gone for the enrichment of an asset class that perhaps didn't need it. So I think that's the way of thinking.
Yeah.
It's always a first loss argument, but it's also a wider systemic in a super scarce situation that we are with first loss. It should really go where it's needed.
I suppose it's also important for the reputation of blended finance as a practice or as an asset class, because I can imagine that, you know, even just the perception that, you know, funds intended to go to development end up, you know, let's say private investors who come in and then they end up making more money, that just really looks bad, even if it's just a perception. So it's probably wise to be quite careful to avoid that impression.
And investors that come into this kind of structures, institutional investors that come into this kind of structures are usually very interested in responsible investment. So the last thing they also want, they want to get a commensurate appropriate return, but they don't want to be seen as abusers. So from a reputational perspective for them, it's also important.
Yeah.
But one thing that I would say in that regard is perceptions change. And we talk about vehicles that are 20, 25 years in our cases, right? A really long duration.
Mm-hmm.
So the perception that we have today at the level of de-risking we have, maybe in 20 years, or 15 years, or in 10 or in 5, is different because investors would have built a different experience with the asset class. So I think we need to always remember that at any one point in time, I always compare it to the way my parents brought me up. And those parenthood practices are different from the way I bring up my child. And some of the things my mom would have done and said or fed me back in the day are very different. And I would never do them with my own child today, right? And it's a little bit similar. So I'm really looking forward to see how those perceptions are going to change over time. And if they change in a way that we'll say, oh, we need far less first loss now, we would have won.
Yeah.
So in a way, being criticized from the future is actually a good thing for the wider market dynamic.
Yeah, that's, these long-term contracts, as you point out, they carry a special set of risks, of course, just because so much can change over that long of a time. Okay, but I want to ask you for the end, I think blended finance is something that many graduates are quite interested in because it's something where you can leverage all the skills you learned at school. It has complexity. It is exciting. What would you advise young graduates to do if they want to go into that space?
Arm yourself with patience. Keep your mind open because blended finance requires creativity. And figure out who are the players that actually can make a difference. What are the levers in the system? Blended finance is about understanding system dynamics and incentives at the end of the day and having that creativity, but also requires a very technical layer. I wouldn't have been able to do blended finance if I hadn't been in structured finance before, if I hadn't done project finance before, if I hadn't done stakeholder negotiations, if I hadn't worked with development banks. So I think to be a successful blended finance professional, you need to have a background and experience in some of those more traditional asset classes. It's incredibly helpful to then be able to be a seasoned blended finance professional. What is important, however, is don't lose your creativity and passion in between, because what I have seen for those that have actually gotten funds to fruition has been passion keeps you when it's tough. And it does get tough multiples of times. That Jenga almost looks like it will break down on multiple occasions. So you have to keep hope. You have to have stamina. You have to have passion, because that allows you to see hope in the long run and keep on going, keep on thinking about creative solution, keep on engaging. Transparency, trust, how do you build those relationships? And it comes down to integrity. It comes down to who we are as people. And I will assume people that are interested in blended finance probably strike quite high on integrity. So good luck to you all that you want to get into that space. I am excited that the younger generation is actually indeed interested. And, you know, I hope to see more and more competitors come, because that means that we're actually in a growing market.
What a wonderful piece of advice. Thank you, Nadia. And I can feel how the passion that's carried you through these years is coming out at this moment.
Still there.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's still there. I can hear it. Great. So that was actually already a beautiful way to end it, although it is tradition that I ask people what they hope will happen over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, sort of in the space that they overlook. So I'm going to ask that to you as well.
I hope we get to see more entrants in the space at large scale. We need scale in this space. So more mainstream investors, more mainstream asset managers, collaboration between catalytic capital in order to pool catalytic capital into one place, streamline it, make it easier to invest. Let's standardize some of these practices so that it's not a square peg to the round hole. And last but not least is move investors from tactical asset allocation to strategic asset allocation. I have a place on that balance sheet where we can easily tap into blended finance and see more and passionate younger people take over some of that work from us so I can, you know, move on. And when I move on is when we have other people that can take from us.
I'm sure you wouldn't move on before it's in safe hands. I see that.
And there's more and more safe hands. So I'm very happy about this dynamic. Keep on coming.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Nadia, thank you so much. That was very insightful.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Fantastic. All the best.
Innovations in Sustainable Finance. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Julian Kölbl.